720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth and Connor McKnight in with you till 2:45. We're going to get to some basketball, talk about all that good stuff. We've got a lot to talk about coming up on the show today. Of course, we have lots to say and discuss and consider about Cosby, about Rahm Emanuel.
Ah, yes.
About New Year's Eve, about technology, about all kinds of things.
We've got big topics and then kind of the fun topics like you have at the end of the year. I mean, some real things in police reform and training, or maybe not reform, but definitely changes in the way they're going to be operating. And then you've got fun stuff like Northwestern opening, you know, conference play against Nebraska, and then just, you know, what your New Year's, you know, plans and resolutions
are. What's your deal?
Yeah, exactly. What are you going to do?
I love all the year-end stuff. The other day, Jameson Oswald and I had Jim DeRogatis on the show to talk about kind of his favorite albums of the year. What a hard task to come up with that. And he picked his 40 top albums.
40? He went 40 deep?
He went 40 deep.
And that is impressive.
And it spanned a lot of genres, too. It was really hard. But I just love the year-end stuff to kind of look back of what do we do in restaurants? What do we do in music? What do we do in movies and sports and all that kind of stuff? And then I like putting people on the hot seat to make predictions for the year ahead of what he thinks is going to happen.
That's the fun stuff.
We're all winging it.
You just put a prediction on somebody, and then you hold it to it. You got to make sure you hold somebody to their prediction that next year after.
Especially if they're right.
Exactly.
Because then you can say, right here on this station, so-and-so predicted that would be the presidential winner.
Yeah. You tune in again next year at this time, you're going to find out exactly what's going to happen in 2016.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so where do you fall on all this, on the Emanuel topic and the police? I mean, it's complex, right?
It's not.
I don't even want to say it's polarizing because it's not. It's too nuanced to be polarizing.
You're probably right. There's so many layers to it that to have one view on the entirety of a reform here would probably be too simplistic. So you take a look at, and like Amy said, 2 o'clock, Rahm Emanuel is going to have his press conference on the new training procedures and issuing tasers to more cops. Getting those in the hands of more police officers here in town. In incidents like you've seen in the past year, just in the past couple of months here in town, you start to think, at least from the outsider's perspective, and that's where we all start on this, right? I mean, we don't all have, you know, the inside knowledge of how a police officer is trained and what that training goes through. And at worst, Amy, I think we can get the view of, oh, okay, a cop has gone through whatever training he's gone through or she's gone through to be in a high-stress situation with a firearm, and that's just pretty much the same as me playing Call of Duty at home. Or that's pretty much just the same as watching, like, Saving Private Ryan or something like that. And you tend to get desensitized just to the work that police officer has to go through to make the correct decision in a high-stress environment. And even with all that work, there are still wrong decisions that get made. So you start to think of, at least I do, I start to think of, okay, what other options can this police officer be given to make a better or at least less lethal decision in places where that's a potential? And it seems like this taser idea at least is one step in the right direction.
Yeah, because if you've only got two options and it's do something or do nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And you're in a very high stress situation.
And when the something is a final option, you know, yeah. I mean, that's a very permanent decision.
Right. Now that said, see, there's another spot where there's a lot of nuances, right? Because
definitely.
I think when the Laquan McDonald video came out, and you see that kid getting dropped,
right.
Everybody immediately said, why didn't you hit him in the kneecap? Why did it have to be a fatal shot?
Sure.
You know, so there's that. I mean, there's all these little nuances to it. And I've never been a cop. I've never been in that situation. I've never been called upon to do something like that. I've never been on either side of that, right? So it's difficult. But I think having this extra tool in the toolbox of another option that you would try first, it seems like a reasonable one.
It does. And especially when, and I know that there are people who have, you know, medical issues whereby a taser could be a lethal option. And I understand that in some circumstances, given, you know, a person's medical history, it can be a lethal thing. I just feel like you said, more tools in the toolbox and more options to the officer only keeps him or her safer. At least it seems that way.
Definitely. There was a guest that I had on the business lunch show. It's a local company called Salt Supply, and it's two neighbors in Humboldt Park, and they, upon moving in, witnessed a fatal shooting right in front of the house, and were so moved and scared and worried for that and for their family's safety that both of the guys came from a product development background, and they kind of re-engineered all those components, and they started with bullets. And so they created something it's interesting. It's a gun, and it looks like a very intimidating gun. It looks like a big old Glock, very modern-looking weapon. But what it shoots is a chemically suspended proprietary pepper blend. So it's like macing somebody, but it will hang in the air and kind of make a wall So if I fire this at you, it's going to hurt like a paintball.
This is definitely not a seasoning. We're talking about something that definitely stop someone in their tracks.
I mean, it's like bear mace. It will put you in respiratory distress. I think he called it a controlled asthma attack is what he said on the air.
Really?
So he was saying, well, in my house, the plan is if the alarm goes off, my wife and I will, one of us will get to that gun, shoot the bottom stair of our home, and it will suspend for about 10 minutes this wall of this pepper gas to stop an intruder from penetrating it.
Interesting that it's an area of effect kind of weapon too, not just a personalized sort of thing. You start to think of, you know, crowd control situations and things like that where less than lethal options can be afforded to a police officer. I really wonder where, and I'd love to hear from, you know, police officers in general. Less than lethal options, it seems like we don't have enough of them, or like as smart as this civilization has become in making weapons of many, many kinds.
Right.
Why not the less than lethal ones? You know, why aren't we looking into things that can, you know, at least dissuade someone from making a decision that's going to put other people's lives in general?
Certainly.
Or in jeopardy. Yeah. And I just wonder where, you know, where that kind of innovation is, and if there's resistance to it, why? I imagine there's probably good reasons.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's an important one. And I think, you know, that conversation, especially as we go into an election year, it's all just like gun control, yay or nay. And I think having other options, and as you point out, as smart as we are, you know, we can send a tweet to the other side of the world in immediate real time, but we can't figure out our options are very black and white for home protection, for crowd control, things like that. So I think that would be an interesting area, like the weapon startup technology realm would be super interesting of just what are our non-lethal options.
You would imagine if you can make a reliable one, something that a police officer knows that he or she can go to in a situation where their lives or others would be in jeopardy, then the market, I mean, just from a financial standpoint, the market in and of itself would be one that would lead you to, you know, putting out a great product and maybe making some money if that's something that you make a reliable effort.
Well, definitely. And I think the most interesting times for innovation are when you have to act, when you have, you know, you have no other option.
Necessity is the mother, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So something interesting will come out of that. So I would be interested to, we should do more research on that because I'm sure somebody's doing something besides our friends in Humboldt Park behind Salt Supply.
Well, we've got a show tomorrow. We can explore it then.
We're going to explore this. We'll get back to you on that. You know what? We're about out of time. We got to take a break, but let's take a quick call real quick. Hi, Ralph. You're on WGN.
Yeah. I was a police officer and I want to say that, you know, what happened to the McDonald kid was wrong, but I want people to consider putting themselves in the shoes of a policeman who carries a gun every day. And my father was on the job for 35 years, and he always said, you never know how you're going to react in a situation. You know, you could say you're going to do this, and you could say you're going to do that, but you never know until you get into that situation.
Sure.
And 9 out of 10 policemen are good people. I think a lot of things have to change. I think the way people interact with the police has to change, not just the police officer, but the way people interact with the police. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the comment,
Ralph.
Yeah,
thanks, Ralph.
All right. Well, I was going to ask him what he thought about tasers, but he seemed like he was in a hurry.
He did.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a bit. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about this Cosby situation because some charges have been filed. He's expected to be arraigned. And we're going to be talking about that here in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Amy Guth, Connor McKnight. In with you till 2:45. We're in for Bill and Wendy today. Bill and Wendy part two, anyway. That's what we're doing. We're hanging out. Well, there's a lot of stuff to get to today, certainly. There's lots of big news things happening. And at 2 o'clock or shortly thereafter, we'll get you to the Rahm Emanuel press conference talking about the new plan to equip Chicago PD with tasers. We're going to be talking all about that. But right now, on the phone, we have ABC News correspondent David Blaustein. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Amy. How are you? Hi, Connor.
Great. You know, we're talking a little bit about this situation. It seems as though some new evidence has popped up in the Cosby situation. Apparently, it was reopened just this summer, the investigation, that is, after some new evidence came to light. What is the new evidence as people are looking at it, and how does it directly affect, you know, what's going to happen next in this criminal procedure?
Well, I don't think it's new evidence. It's old evidence. It was just evidence that we were made privy to because Bill Cosby's deposition in this particular case had been sealed. But it somehow became public, and that's when they decided to reopen the case and investigate it. And today criminal charges were filed. This is the case with Andrea Constand, the woman who claims that Bill Cosby gave her three blue pills when she went over to his house 12 years ago, and then he molested and raped her. And that's a story that had been out there. Again, they settled. The deposition was sealed, and so nobody really knew about it, and it was sort of, it was swept under the rug. And there had been some other allegations against Bill Cosby over the years, but we as members of the media, well, we didn't really press him on it. I was guilty of that. I actually had him in a studio about 5 or 6 years ago in a project he was working on. He had a rap group, and he had some of the rappers with him. He did not rap on it, but he was preaching to young black men about being responsible. But that's really how this started. That's how all these stories about Bill Cosby allegedly raping women came to light. It was because a comedian named Hannibal Buress, who people are now much more familiar with, in October, in a comedy set in Bill Cosby's hometown of Philadelphia, called Bill Cosby a rapist. And, it was kind of funny the way he did it, but obviously it's not funny. But it was something that went viral. And then some of the women who alleged that Bill Cosby had raped them, or say claimed to have been victims of Bill Cosby, started writing about it. And those things started going viral. And more people came forward. And now over 50 women have come forward and claimed that Bill Cosby sexually harassed or raped them. And all of their stories are very, very similar.
And wasn't there an element of social media that came from Cosby himself or his social media team? Wasn't there something about a meme that he had asked people to use a hashtag or initiate a Twitter chat or something like that? Wasn't that something that happened kind of around the same time as the Hannibal Buress bit?
That did. And you know what? I don't specifically remember what it was, but it was something that Bill Cosby's team did ask the public to do, an opinion about Bill Cosby, which is a mistake. We see this time and time again, public figures who are really vulnerable because of something that they've done in public or something they've been accused of or a misstep that they've taken. They've gone to the Twitter sphere and asked for some sort of appeal. And, you know, how could you not know that Twitter is just full of snark? It's just waiting for somebody. It's like hungry sharks in the water waiting for somebody to put some chum out there and bite and attack. And that's exactly what they did, and that backfired. And, you know, Bill Cosby, we're not here to talk about anyone else, but Bill Cosby isn't the only person that's happened to. It happens to political figures all the time as well. But yeah, that was an element to this. But I mean, it really is all about social media, because you have to sit there and ask the question, well, if there were all these allegations and these various women who have said it before, why didn't it take hold in the media, and why didn't we take it seriously? Why didn't the world take it seriously? And it speaks to the power of celebrity and how people kind of get blinded by that. And, you know, we see, look, famous people are falsely accused all the time, but there has been a preponderance of women who have said this about Bill Cosby, and kind of shame on us for not really taking it seriously. And it's an interesting dynamic to explore. Why did it take us this long? Why did it take Hannibal Buress in a video that's not that great? You know, the quality's not that great during a comedy routine where he lays into Bill Cosby. Why did it take that particular moment for something to click?
Right.
Talking with ABC News correspondent David Blaustein here on WGN 720 about the old, I guess, new to us, but old revelations in the Cosby situation. Is the manner by which this new evidence, again, new to us evidence, came public, do you figure that that's going to be part of Bill Cosby's defense in this, that perhaps that information shouldn't have been out there in the first place and is perhaps inadmissible?
I think they're going to try to do that, but I feel like if that were the case, that would have happened already. I mean, I think I'm sure there are legal statutes that where they can argue that's the case, because this is information that was not supposed to be public, but the fact of the matter is it is public, and there's nothing they can really do about that. You know, you can't stick the genie back in the bottle once the genie's out of the bottle. And that's the case here. I mean, and what is said in this deposition is that he did in fact, obtain quaaludes? And that was a question before this was unsealed and before this came out over the summer. People were questioning these women. Well, did Bill Cosby really have those drugs? Did he really have those quaaludes? And there was nothing out there to prove that he did, so he could deny it. But then here is this evidence. Here is this smoking gun, if you will. Yeah, he obtained quaaludes, and he said he obtained quaaludes with the objective of having sex with women. He didn't say to rape them or to forcibly have sex, but that was his intention, and he says as much.
Mm-hmm. And run us through a little bit of, I know there's a statute of limitations kind of looming over this. How far along must this case proceed underneath, or, you know, before we hit up against that deadline of the statute of limitations of 12
years?
Well,
I'll tell you what, Amy, that's a great question, because that's, you sit here and say, why is this happening today? I mean, this was 12 years ago, because the statute of limitations runs out next month. It's 12 years. And that's why they're doing this in Pennsylvania. That's why they're taking action now. And, you know, he's facing at least 10 years in prison. I mean, Bill Cosby could very well spend the rest of his life in prison. And by the way, this is just the first set of charges. I mean, remember, there are over 50 women who are accusing Bill Cosby of doing the same thing that Andrea Constant is accusing him of doing. So there are going to be other investigations and perhaps other criminal charges in other jurisdictions around the country.
David, appreciate the time. Appreciate the information. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Absolutely. David Blaustein of ABC News talking about the Bill Cosby situation and the new revelations in that case. You know, he made an interesting point, David did, I think, Amy, that, you know, why did it take this long? Why did it take some grainy viral video of Hannibal Buress doing a stand-up set in Philly for us to look at this? And I, you know, working in sports, you see this a lot. You know, you like to hold up your icons or whatever. You know, what do I tell my kids about, you know, Lance Armstrong being a complete loser? You know, all this kind of stuff. I think, you know, we're in this era now with the way we're able to consume our heroes or our icons or our television. Our icons are no longer our icons. You know, this is, everything is exposed, and everything is exposed as quickly as it can be in this day, in the way we consume media now. So,
well, and I think too, there's an expectation of interaction now with our icons. It used to be they were kind of up on the hill and we could hear what we wanted to and what we needed to, as controlled by their PR people. And now, especially with social media, we have a lot more access, and the expectation of access to our celebrities, to our sports heroes, to all of those things.
And with more access becomes more potential. And not talk about, you know, Bill Cosby's case specifically here, but with that more access comes more potential for that icon, you know, quote unquote. I'm doing the air quotes all day in studio. More potential for that icon to make a mistake.
Yeah.
And bring him or herself down from said podium.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we see all the time a celebrity will have some kind of meltdown on Twitter. Or
be a real person. They'll be a real person on Twitter and not be this, you know, shining example of what you thought they were in a movie.
Right. Right. And it's not the polished thing that their press agents will put out. It's suddenly this, someone's having a meltdown about being in the airport. Been there. We've seen this, but maybe not in such a bold way with a million Twitter followers. Right. All right, my friends, we're going to get you to break, and then we can come back. We're going to check in with the news real quick. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth and Connor McKnight. We're in for Bill and Wendy this fine afternoon. You know, I love this time of year because we look back at kind of the big stories and given topics and start looking ahead for what we can expect in the year ahead and all that kind of good stuff. And, you know, my heart lies in technology, so we could not possibly go through the show without talking a little bit about some of the big, big stories in 2015. Joining us now is Ian Schur. He's from CNET. Hi, Ian. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. Nice to talk to you today. Happy almost New Year.
Yes, definitely. You too.
So for you, what were some of the biggest tech stories of the year?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of what has happened this year has revolved around two really big themes. One has been the wearable technology stuff. We've had stuff like the Apple Watch come out and Fitbit had its IPO. And you had all of these kind of this growth of putting sensors on our bodies and trying to figure out whether or not there's a real industry here or whether as most of the surveys show, people play with it for about 6 months and then dump it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been very fascinating. And the other one that's been really interesting to me has been the security issues. There have been so many major hacks over this last year. I mean, if you just look at the major ones, we have Sony, right, which was a huge thing, right? It caused an international incident that included North Korea, of all places. You had the rise of state-sponsored hacking. You had the Office of Personnel Management in the government. You had all these types of terrible things happen. And the worst part is it doesn't seem to be getting better.
Right.
And so those two types of themes really seem to permeate throughout all of the technology coverage this year, which was, you know, both interesting and also horrifying when you think about it.
So, Ian, what is the future of personal security? You know, I'm 30, so I guess I'm a millennial, and I'm supposed to be the guy who's like, and I'm literally looking at my iPhone right now, trying to find where that, I think it's Passbook or something like that, that's supposed to hold all of my credit card information, and I can just, you know, walk up to wherever to pay for anything I want, presumably to the Apple store to pay for their new watch. I don't trust it, and I'm 30. How does Apple or other large companies that want to get all of this information just scannable and or wearable, how do they get me to trust it again?
Yeah, and that's a big problem. So as we've written about on CNET a couple of times now, there's actually a lot of new technology coming out to try and solve this, because the top security problems that most of you and I and everyone else have is that we use bad passwords and we use the same password everywhere we go.
Right.
And so the way to solve some of these problems are to take out the human equation of where we can screw up, you and me, because we can't be trusted to do our own security. That is the thing that I have learned through many years. So when it comes to Passbook, for example, what Apple and Google and a number of other companies have done is that they're actually trying to get rid of your credit card altogether. So a lot of us use our credit cards. We might end up using our credit card on a skimming machine by accident, which is where hackers actually put extra technology on a credit card reader, and then it pulls the information off your credit card, which is really in that little strip that's on the back that we've been using for decades, and they steal your information with it. So instead, what Apple and Google have done is that they've put special chips in their phones that create a unique code every time you want to pay for something. And it's already been set up with the bank and everything. It's using an algorithm. And what happens is that code only works at one time, and then it gets tossed away. And so what they're doing is they're actually creating a new credit card number every time you have a transaction, which saves you from the possibility of being hacked, because once you've used it, even if the hacker got it, they can't use it at all. It's useless. That's one of the ways that they're trying to solve these problems.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think too, a sort of a peripheral topic to that issue has been data privacy. I think that's been kind of bubbling for a couple of years, but this year we saw the European High Court rule on that, particularly how Facebook uses user data and how it can't, you know, the route it is used and what it is used for and what is used has been restricted and changed quite a bit. And I think we're probably going to see a lot more of that in thinking around that topic in the year ahead.
Oh, we absolutely will. But there's also another aspect of it, which is the concerns around terrorism, mm-hmm. right? Because as there's been all this debate about how our information is being stored and used and targeting for advertising, the other end of this has been that these companies are beefing up the security with which they use to store our information and to share it with each other. So they've been using, for example, this thing that encrypts all of our messages, right? Which means it jumbles it up with an algorithm that basically means that only the intended recipients will see it. And governments hate that, because that means that if there's a potential terrorist attack, they can't go to Apple or Facebook or Google and say, give me that information, because even they can't read it, right? And so it's security that's so good that they can't even get into it. And so even a court order can't compel it. And so they get really worried, because now you have, for example, during the Paris attacks, there was a lot of debate about were these coordinated using messaging services that encrypt information. And, you know, there's this really interesting tenuous problem between us wanting to have our own privacy, right? The company is trying to deal with advertising and making money, which is another problem. And then the government's wants. And all these different things keep coming up. And it's not getting much better either. It keeps coming to a head. And it's going to be very interesting because Silicon Valley has come down very strongly against government intrusion, but at the same time, they're willing to work with advertisers. And it's going to be curious to see how far this can go before something changes.
Talking with Ian Scheer of CNET, about the tech trends of 2015 and what's coming up in 2016. Let's flip ends of the spectrum here, Ian. Let's go to the end user. I've read and seen USB Type-C cords popping up now. I get frustrated because I feel like sometimes they're just making me pop another $40 on a cord that I don't know what the hell it's doing, but it's supposed to be doing something faster, and that's all well and good, but I had to give Apple another $40. Is this a next best thing, or is this just another shot to get me to pay for another white cord?
Well, so you can feel both ways about it, and I don't blame you. The thing is that the USB Type-C, we've actually written a lot about this on CNET. There's a great story about where it's going that we have there. But the reality is that this is supposed to be one of the nirvanas of cords. So for decades, we have been sold all these different types of cords, and you have a bunch of them, right? You have micro USB, you have lightning, you have all of these types of different cords that are frankly annoying to keep track of.
I grab the wrong one every time.
Right. And I don't know about you. I've got a box of them that my family hates, right? Because it's like this big box of cords. And like, why do you have so many? And I'm like, because I may need it. Right. And you never know. So the idea with USB Type-C is that there's just one cord. It does your power. It does connecting to your phone. It does everything. And that's a really interesting idea. It's taken us decades to get here. The thing is that it's been slow on the uptake. It's only been publicly available to consumers for the last year or so. But there's a lot of promise in it. And we saw Apple specifically, which, you know, they tend to be kind of the bleeding edge of some technologies. When they came out with their new MacBook, which was this ultra-thin laptop that was even thinner than the MacBook Air, if you can imagine, it only had a USB Type-C cord. And so that was where you delivered power. That's how you connected to your phone. It was everything. And it's going to be interesting to see. Obviously, the technology industry feels very positive about this, but these cords cost money. Getting everyone to switch is hard. And it's a lot easier when it's an Apple customer because studies and statistics have shown that Apple customers are usually willing to pay more. But when it comes to the rest of us, we're pretty big penny pinchers. Are we willing to shell out for all these new cords? It'll be interesting to watch.
Definitely. All right. Can you stick with us a little bit longer, Ian? I still have so many topics I want to talk to you about technology in the year ahead.
Absolutely.
All right. Excellent. So we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Ian Scheer from CNET about all the big tech stories this year, and we're going to get some predictions for the year ahead here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth and Connor McKnight. We're in for Bill and Wendy today with you till about 2:45. Coming up after 2 o'clock, we're going to get you to that Mayor Rahm Emanuel press conference about equipping Chicago police officers with tasers. So we're going to be getting you to that here in just a bit. But right now, we have our good friend Ian Scheer on the phone. He's from CNET, and he's always a wealth of information, and we're always happy to have him with us. So, Ian, you know, another thing I think we saw a lot of this year in the technology world was we saw a lot about the leadership of behind technology. We saw Marissa Meyer talking about maternity leave that she was not taking. We saw Mark Zuckerberg talking about paternity leave he is taking. We saw, we saw Sheryl Sandberg very publicly grieving for the death of her husband. We saw Jack Dorsey coming back after Dick Costolo was ousted as the CEO, and lots of, you know, Wall Street has reacted to those things. And I think that's very interesting, too, that we've seen so much about the leadership in the tech world.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of drama over it. And part of that has been because the technology industry has become so big. And, you know, the sense that it is one of the most powerful parts of our economy, that people are just watching every little move. And so it's getting scrutinized in a way that really hasn't happened before. And so that's why you see stuff like you brought up. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has been much more public about not only his personal life. He had a daughter this year, and he decided to take paternity leave. But also, you saw a lot of Silicon Valley people actually coming out politically and speaking in a way that you really had not seen before. Tim Cook, for example, the CEO of Apple, which is one of the world's largest companies, he came out as gay, and he started actually speaking out on gay issues and speaking out on human rights issues, which is really fascinating. When you think of Apple, you say, hey, it's just an iPhone maker. But they really have started trying to take their power within the country and start applying it in more than just the technology issues. Again, you saw Twitter, right, which was on the forefront of all of these issues around sexism and the way women are being treated on the internet, the issues around even diversity within its own staff, because it's a far majority white male staff, that it became kind of a central hub of all these discussions around the technology industry. And, of course, so it's been very fascinating to watch because Silicon Valley itself is trying to become more than just a boys club, which is how it's the way it's seen and the way the technology industry has always kind of felt. And you have all these issues coming up around it. It's been really interesting.
Yeah, and just this week we see Jeffrey Siminoff being brought into Twitter as the new head of diversity with a lot of pushback. You know, they're saying, hey, you know, the previous person in that role said, oh, we want to, here's the demographic information. We want Twitter to be so much more diverse and represent our users. And they, you know, fully are saying, you know, only, you know, for 30% of our users are Latino, and yet only, you know, less than 3% of our employees are, and zero of our leadership. And suddenly, you know, I think there was a lot of pushback in the last 24 hours about this announcement, because here's, they bring in a white guy to fix diversity, which is not to say a white guy cannot be sensitive to diversity, cannot lead that. But I think for as much as they've said, we want to really get a handle on this and really, really bring in a more diverse team, particularly in leadership, it's a move under a lot of speculation.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem, is that the Silicon Valley still struggles a lot with being able to get beyond the fact that most of the people in leadership are white and they're male. And, you know, as you brought up, this guy who came in, Jeffrey Siminoff, he came from Apple, right, which is a very is again a white, a majority white male leadership. And, you know, he's coming into Twitter, which has it's even compared to its peers, is much whiter in male. And so it's going to be really interesting to watch. Obviously, the industry sees that these are problems, but part of the problem is that a lot of it feels like they're just talking and we're not seeing any movement. And in fact, some of the companies have been releasing diversity data now for a couple of years, and we're seeing them backsliding. It's actually getting worse.
Right.
And so, and what's interesting as well, we had a whole package around this called Solving for XX, which we did on CNET. And part of the discussion that we had was that this argument around STEM education, right, science, technology, engineering, and math, that part of it was really just a smokescreen, because a lot of the leadership in Silicon Valley do not have those degrees. They have liberal arts degrees. But here they're expecting women and people of color to have these degrees to be able to get to move up in the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually really fascinating, because there's these weird double standards that keep coming up even today that are just not being solved. And that's what's also coming up a lot.
Yeah. Well, so as we look at the year ahead, I think, you know, there's so many changes coming to Facebook. They're talking about moving into second and third tier markets, even some developing markets where broadband technology, high speed internet, very fast and fancy smartphones, just not available. So we saw them already this year move that video ad to a carousel of photos so it could load on a less sophisticated piece of machinery. We've seen them testing out an e-commerce platform in Southeast Asia primarily. We see them kind of playing around with something like Kickstarter. We see them kind of flirting with bringing Notes back, ostensibly to compete with the Medium platform. You know, and we also saw that milestone over the summer where one in seven people on the face of the earth used Facebook in the month of August of this year. So what do you think other things we can expect to see from Facebook and the other, you know, tech giants, the biggies, in the year ahead?
Well, I think what's going to be really interesting is that right now, as you pointed out, one in seven people are already using Facebook on a daily basis. And so the real question is, how do they get bigger? How do they even get more people? Because once you've won and you've become kind of the king of the mountain, how do you stay there and how do you get even bigger than that? And Mark Zuckerberg's dealing with this in a lot of really fascinating ways. So one of them is that they acquired this company called Oculus, which makes virtual reality goggles. Now, what do virtual reality and social networking have to do with one another? Well, Mark Zuckerberg believes that the next way we're going to use computers is going to be this stuff where we take a screen, we strap it to our face, and we look at a computer-generated world. And, you know, he sees it as we went from computers to smartphones, and then this will be next. And he's made a big bet on it. I mean, it cost him $2 billion to buy the company. He's invested much more since. And they're launching their product in the coming year, which will be this headset that we buy that works with computers. It's going to be really fascinating to see whether or not that changes the way we use these computers. And more importantly, whether it changes Facebook and whether it changes the way that that company works. You know, some of the other things we're also seeing from them is that we're seeing a lot more focus on this messaging stuff. Right? We talked earlier about the issues around privacy. But on top of that, they're also using their messaging stuff to actually turn it into another way we use the Internet. So the Messenger app, which you can download for your phone for free and works with Facebook, it has hundreds of millions of people using it on a monthly basis. And what they're doing is they're starting to add stuff to it, like you can order an Uber taxi through it. You can order food through it. You can do all these types of different things. And they're trying to even now apply artificial intelligence to it so I can ask it, hey, Facebook, what do you think my friend Sarah wants for her birthday? And it'll actually go through some of the likes and some of the stuff that she has and then also look at the trends in the world, and it'll come up with a suggestion. Those are really fascinating ideas that are very fanciful. I mean, if you imagine a decade ago, we would never have thought we were going to do this. And now these companies are actually trying to go that path.
Ian, thanks so much for the talk. Awesome glimpse into the future. I, for one, welcome our computer overlords and rue the day that it'll all happen for us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ian.
My pleasure.
Ian Scheer of CNET. We've got Kim's News coming up in 2 minutes. And, of course, we'll bring you live the Rahm Emanuel press conference on equipping Chicago police with tasers. That's all coming up in just a couple right here, 720 WGN.
WGN, Amy Guth and Connor McKnight in for Bill and Wendy. We're joined right now with our good friend Ryan Burrow. Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Well, how are you guys doing?
I'm going to turn your microphone on and
sure,
everything. It's
sure.
going to be good.
Thanks.
Well, so we all sat here listening to the Rahm Emanuel presser and heard a lot of things. And I think, you know, we want to take a little bit deeper look at some of that, because I believe I heard that instead of 3 days of desk duty, it would be 30 days. For 30. Now, was that for an officer who has discharged their weapon or who's actually shot someone?
He, the way they referenced it, officer involved shooting. We don't know if this is someone who just discharged it. We don't know if someone who shot only a person, if it's someone who shot a dog that was attacking. They didn't get into the specifics of that. But they did want to slow things down. And I think doing that, giving a 30-day rest, essentially, or desk duty for an on-duty officer would make an on-duty officer think before pulling the gun. Look, if I do this, if I pull this weapon, I know I'm going to be behind a desk. I'm not going to be on the street doing my beat for at least a month, right? Mm-hmm. While this is investigated. So it's all part of this. Let's slow down the process a little bit. Once we arrive at a scene, let's try to de-escalate. This is part of that.
I wonder if it's thought of there, that kind of, you know, 10 times increase in time spent on desk duty, if that's seen as a deterrent by the Chicago Police Department, or if that's more of an evaluation process, because you can't effectively police if you're also worried about the consequences, you know, the long terms, that kind of, I mean, yeah, I don't mean to say worried about complete consequences, because obviously you've got a life on the line there, but you have to be able to react as well. You can't take that kind of gut feeling out of a guy either.
Well, remember, if you discharge your weapon under this policy, it's not like you're going to be fired.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's not the case. It's just a, whoa, time out here. Let's go back and look at what happens. But I think mentally, and I'm sure the Fraternal Order of Police will weigh in on what they think of this. But, you know, it's one of those moments where, you know, if you and I pull up on a scene and we're cops and we know things are hot and heavy, you know, rather than grabbing for the gun right away, we might think to ourselves, wait a minute, if we do this, you know,
sure,
think about what this means. Is this going to be worth it for me? And it may be.
Yeah.
I mean, if their lives are threatened, absolutely. But in some situations, and granted, we're still not getting a lot of specifics about what happened over the weekend in that shooting of the 19-year-old and the 55-year-old woman.
Right.
You know, perhaps if you know, the officer had known, hey, I'm going to be off a month, maybe this wouldn't have happened. And then, of course, we've got the taser situation, which I didn't know if you wanted to lead into that at all.
Definitely.
But that was another thing. Doubling the amount of tasers. Right now, he said about 700 are out there among the force and being used. Now that's going to go up to about 1,400. And that will include one taser in each of the cruisers that are out and about at night. So some of these situations, like Laquan McDonald, like we saw over the weekend, perhaps tasers would have prevented you know, death.
I know in some cases there's reticence on the part of a police department, not specifically this one, I'm just saying in general, to go to more less than lethal weapons, or just to have the number there, whether that's because of effectiveness or whether that's because of the weapon itself or in its usage. Is there a kind of reticence there in the police department or by the Fraternal Order, as far as you're aware of?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that they were pointing out, is they were looking at 15 other cities to see how they handle this. And you know, I believe Seattle was mentioned, Portland was mentioned.
Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah, it was. I got to go back and listen to it to see how exactly they, you know, how exactly they did this. But, you know, it's like I said, it's all part of this stepping back and kind of reflecting moment before because as you know, one of the protesters said probably the best line I think I've heard all week, you know, only at that point they said one in five police officers has a taser, but every one of them has a gun. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the use of lethal force is so quick and so easy, as opposed to, you know, using a taser or maybe finding some other way around the situation. And, you know, in this press conference, Emmanuel said, let's slow down, essentially, and you know, let's work on a longer process and not go right into full throttle as soon as we arrive at the scene.
We were sitting here watching Twitter as all this was going on and just watching reactions from people also listening along. And it seemed like there was a lot of conversation around the idea that maybe his emphasis on retraining was somehow invalidating the training that's already there.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting to find out, too, as we go into the Laquan McDonald shooting trial, because, you know, Officer Jason Van Dyke could obviously turn around as his defense and go, well, wait a minute here.
I wasn't
properly trained. Sure. You know, the way that I was trained was we pull up if we feel any, you know, any kind of threat. And I believe that probably Dan Herbert, his attorney, is working on that kind of defense right now, saying, well, wait a minute. So has everything up to this point been invalid? You know, and then that could open up. Who knows?
But on the flip side of that, you know, it does sort of validate that the way that Betty Jones and Quintonio LeGrier were handled, it does sort of point to that.
Sure.
that was mishandled.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, this is it'll be interesting to see how, you know, we know John Escalante is the interim police superintendent. I don't know what his aspirations are as far as becoming the full time superintendent. Obviously, there is going to be a nationwide search, but it almost seems as though they want to have a plan in place for the new guy or gal, whoever steps in, to kind of begin implementing this mode versus the Superintendent McCarthy mode.
Yeah, definitely.
So is the expectation here that this is kind of, I don't know, maybe not the first point, but definitely kind of the next overarching kind of diffusion of police prospects, of police procedure as it comes to violent situations like this? I mean, are we going to have more of these press conferences as Rahm and the interim superintendent kind of rework the situation?
After every press release that the mayor sends out, it always says, this is only the beginning.
Yeah.
This is only the beginning. Remember, we've got a Department of Justice investigation going on. They're looking at all the policing policies. I was actually kind of surprised that he did this right away, but then I thought about it. And why, you know, he's not going to wait. He's not going to wait a year and a half, 2 years for the Department of Justice to make these changes. And that's one of the reasons he flew back from mm-hmm. vacation in Cuba. He wanted to get this thing probably before the year began.
A much less emotional Rahm than usual. He seemed a little bit all business. I think we all expected him to be a little more passionate about this.
Sure.
And he seemed a little bit flat with his emotions. Very matter of fact about it.
Maybe a little of that Cuban Zen. I don't know.
Right.
I mean,
maybe angry to cut his vacation short.
He's coming back from vacation. I mean, I don't exactly know what he did during that trip. Obviously, we saw how things got heated. I was out there with the protesters on Christmas Eve. You know, they were mm-hmm. walking up. He was long gone at that point, but the protests continued. There was another protest today. They're going to continue even as it gets cold and it gets snowy. You know, the drumbeat's going to continue against mm-hmm. Against him. And I think with the exception of stepping down, which is what a lot of these people do want, I mean, he fired his police superintendent. He has made some changes. I don't know if that's going to make everyone happy. I mean, they believe that he's the problem.
Right.
You know, I mean, he's trying to cater to what I believe is most of their desires, with the exception of him going.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And it was interesting to see that the protest reached his front yard even last
night.
Yeah,
that was an interesting one. A couple dozen people were out there for that one. And I guess they ordered pizza and donuts, and it was interesting.
Not for Rahm, just for them.
No, for them.
It was a situation where they're welcoming the guy and then influencing policy. Ryan, thanks so much for stepping in. Appreciate the breakdown.
Thanks, Ryan.
Amy, that's just about going to do it for us. It's a pleasure working with you. We'll be back tomorrow.
Indeed.
From 1 until 3, hanging out in place of Bill and Wendy. You have some good stuff coming up. Like I said, conference play starts today for the Northwestern Wildcats. They're 12-1, if you hadn't listened before, and their only loss comes to a top 10 team in North Carolina early on in the season. So you want a chance at an NCAA tournament? Now begins that kind of quest. Andy Mazur has the call here on WGN. Northwestern takes on Nebraska in just a little bit. Tomorrow we'll work through some of the New Year's resolutions, some of the big topics of the year of 2015,
it's
and
New
what
Year's
we're looking
Eve.
Forward
we're
to.
We're going
to
keep it a little bit lighter tomorrow.
We are. I think so. Maybe the Carnarvon wagon finds its way onto the show. I mean, we could take it from
that.
Brian Noonan and then liberate it from the Rokan
sure.
show. You know, use that whole thing.
I'm on board with this.
I think that's the way we do these
Let's
things.
Let's do this.
For Amy, I'm Connor. You've got Northwestern Hoops. They're playing Nebraska right here, 720 WGN.